like to maybe look at something we haven't looked at before, because we are now approaching the discussion, weekly reading, the giving of the Torah. So let's try to look at a theme which really weaves its way through all of Torah. The more background you have, the more I hope you'll discover in this. But really, we can't really do everything at once, so try to lay down the theme as clearly as we can, but you really need to discuss it from many more points of view. We can only scratch the surface, really. But I hope you'll be able to use this as a framework, and then as we go further, or as you in your own studies, your own learning, be able to see more in it. And I just want to speak about one idea, and that is why Chumash is five. Chumash means five, right? Why the Torah, or Bible, is in five books. What does it mean? What's the meaning of a pattern of five? And what's the theme, if you like, the thematic development of the books of Torah? Right? What do they reflect in the world? And why is it so important that they are five? I presume you all know enough to know. I'm sure you're all accomplished scholars and Kabbalists. I'm sure you know that 10 is really five, right? You know the 10 commandments that we read about this week are given in two sets of five, each is parallel to the other. And really, the five expand into 10, or the 10 can be grouped in five sets, and I don't think we'll have time this evening to explain why the deep pattern of the world is based on 10 elements, and yet we can group them into five sets. Perhaps some other time we'll be able to do that. But there's no contradiction here. They are the same idea, really, and the root pattern is five steps. So let's see if we can try to understand what lies behind that. You know, the first book of Chumash is Bereishis, that is Genesis, that's where the world is created, the world and the Jewish people, really. That's where the forefathers of the Jewish people established the Jewish people. The transition is Joseph. Yosef is the end of that. Yosef, I'm sure you're aware, is both a father and a son. That's why it's transitional between the two books, the first two books. The first book is Hashem himself creating the world. The second, the book of Shmos, the book of names, where the Jewish people develop their names in Egypt. That means become individuals. And the transition between the book of the fathers, as it's called, as Genesis, and the book of the children, the sons, which is Shmos, where they are named, as it were. The transition, obviously, is Joseph. It doesn't take much to realize that Yosef is that figure who is transitional between father and sons. He is a son, he's one of the 12 tribes, and yet he's a forefather in that he has two tribes of his own, right? Yes, Ephraim and Manasseh. So he really stands at that interface. He's one of the forefathers in the sense that his children are the tribes, two of the tribes. On the other hand, he's also counted as one of the 12 tribes. So he's transitional. You then have the book of Shmos, which is the development of the Jewish people. You then have Vayikra, which is the book of the Mishkan, the sanctuary, later becomes the temple, the point of meeting between these two worlds where Hashem meets us. That's the real theme of Vayikra. You then have the book of Bamidbar in the desert as the Jewish people make their way through the desert with all the fateful ordeals that they face in the desert and the 10 trials that they have that they fail. And then the book of Devarim, which is the book of arriving at the verge of Israel. And that book, as you know, I'm sure, changes tone or style. Instead of it being direct dictation from Hashem, it is Moshe Rabbeinu's, Moses' words that he utters, which Hashem ratifies. It has a different nature, and I'm sure you're aware that it repeats many of the things. For example, the Ten Commandments that we read this week are repeated again with slight variations in that book as well. And that needs understanding. Why is it repeated? The word they use in English, I don't know, English, Greek, whatever it is, Deuteronomy, right, means the second version. That's what it means, right? I'm sure you're all Greek scholars. Well, that's what it means. It means the second time. And the reason is obvious, and that is that it's a duplication in many ways that needs to be understood. What lies behind these five? What is the pattern that's being expressed here? Torah is really an expression in the world of the higher world. That means the roots of reality have this pattern, and they express themselves in the expressed world, and therefore Torah has to be the most perfect description of the world. And we've shared together many times the idea that Torah is not a description of the world, it's a prescription. it is the cause and the reason that the world looks the way it does. And therefore, if in the spiritual world there are five layers, then Torah obviously reflects that as five layers, and the world itself must manifest that pattern. So what lies behind this? What lies behind this? Let's begin maybe and take a look at the five layers of reality. Right? This is not easy material. It reaches deep into the Kabbalistic world. But since everything's really built on this, I think it pays to understand something about it. So let's try to define the pattern if we can and then work through it. What is this pattern of five? First of all, you know, wherever you look in Torah, you will see that all structures have five layers. You know, for example, that the Hashem's name, the divine name, right? That has four letters. But any system of four obviously has a mystical root, right? The point of Genesis, if you like, which is always mysterious. It's something that can't really be seen in itself. In other words, the way our tradition puts it is that the four letters of Hashem's name, you have first a yud, which is a minimal letter, right? The din of a yud is it's just a drop of ink, just a small speck. Then you have a hey, and then a vav, and then a hey. Those are the four letters of the divine name, right? The name we never say, because it's a word that's above the world. If you said it in the world, you'd be lying, because it's not a name that manifests in the world that way. But obviously, those four letters, the root of them, is what's known as the kutsa shel yud. In other words, it's their little fleck or speck or place where the yud begins. Technically speaking, it's where the ink meets the parchment. That point can never be defined. You can never see that. You can never see where nothing becomes something. Because if you look too soon, you don't see anything. And if you look too late, you see the thing itself. You can never see nothing becoming something. I see a lot of very doubtful faces. You can't see where nothing becomes something. Is that? Because if you look too soon, you don't see anything. And if you look too late, you see the thing. You can't see the flashing in of a nothing becoming a something. Where does a musical note begin? You can never grasp the moment of its beginning. You can either hear silence or you hear something. The silence becoming something. Yes, no?
Is there not a difference between looking at an incident and looking over a time frame?
Oh, well, one second. Oh, that's too deep for me. Right now I'm having enough trouble with me. Just hold on a second. The mystical point is what's called yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. You can't represent that. If you try to make a picture of that, it would be a something. Is this clear? If I tried to put a letter into the name, a fifth letter, a first letter of five, that letter would be a letter. It wouldn't be a nothing becoming a something. It would be a something. It's going to be a long night. So therefore, the way we depict it is, we say it's where the yud begins. It's that amazing place where the ink, where the blank space becomes the black letter, but neither of those, where the one becomes the other, right? And therefore it's not represented as a separate letter. So really there are five elements to these four letters. There are four letters that are drawn, written, yudke vavke, but the root of them is the mystical nothing becoming a self. It's always that mysterious point that cannot be depicted. So actually Hashem's name of four letters, it is a pattern of five. There's the genesis of the thing, which can never be understood. Why did Hashem create the world? The beginning of creation always is something that can't be understood. Right? That is called, in the technical word we use, is chesed. Chesed means a kindness or a loving kindness. When something is done for no reason, that's a kindness. If I do something for you for no reason that you can ever discern, it's only my love for you. That means I didn't have to do this. Again, not rachamim, don't make a mistake. Rachamim is where you do something for somebody because he needs it. That's a different story. When you give to somebody who's poor, that's not called chesed, that's called rachamim. The difference between chesed and rachamim is that chesed, kindness, is done with no reason at all. It's done because I want to do this for you, not because you need it. If you need it, then the origin of this movement is your need. There was a sense in which I was obliged by your need. If I'm a sensitive person and you're poor, or you're starving, or you need help, so that evokes my help. And we call that rachamim, mercy. But chesed is not that. Chesed is where I do it for you, not because there's a need, just because I want to. This is the desire of a parent to give birth.
Because you did it for yourself.
No. No. This is, in fact, it's very interesting, is that the very first word you can spell in Hebrew, you can't make any more basic word in Hebrew than Aleph Bet. You just can't get more basic than that. Aleph is not a word. As soon as you construct a word in Hebrew, you take the very first two letters of the alphabet, right? The word means father, Av, and also the male desire, the father's desire to marry and produce a family. Avon in Hebrew means to long for and to desire, right? Not aim. The mother is a different word. She has an Aleph, which is the first letter, and then she has a Mem, which is the middle letter, because the woman is always the one who, yeah, it depends on her. The Hebrew word aim, which means a mother, also means im. That means if. It's up to her. If yes, yes. If no, no. It's up to her, right? Okay. Needs discussion. But the first two letters you can form are the letters for desire, and that describes at a very deep level Hashem's desire. He wants to create a world not because it needs him. It wasn't there. And not because he has any lack. He's not doing it to fulfill a lack in himself. He's doing it simply because he wants to. That's called ultimate goodness. And that's called chesed. And therefore, the Sefer Bereishis, the book of Genesis, is that. It describes the world coming into existence simply because he wants to. Right? And that's called the book of the fathers. Right? The book of this desire, as it were, to bring something into existence simply because of his goodness. That is called chesed. That's why in English they call it loving kindness. It means...
goodness for whom?
What?
Goodness for whom?
Goodness for
chesed whom?
Goodness means it's a mid of yours. Because you're good, you want to give. Right? That's what it means.
I
had problems with him, now I have problems with you. What's the problem?
Sure.
What's the problem?
No, I mean, sure, that everything that we went through, the Yidden, the tribe, everything, it's not the test, it's not for us, we don't.
I'm not sure what you mean. Hold on a second, stay tuned. So the first middah, the beginning of any process, is called chesed. It means a thing done purely out of the goodness of the one who does it. That's the beginning. So you have five elements to the divine name. The soul, for example, has five parts. The human soul has five parts, right? The parts of the soul are, the first part is called ratzon, which means desire. That means any ideation, any process of bringing a thing into the world begins with a desire for that thing, obviously. If there's no motivation, no will, then nothing can ever move. The second level is called machshava, which means a thought. After you have the desire, it's formulated as a thought. The third level is called hirhur, which means material thought. That means it has graphic content, plan, specifics. Then you have what's called dibur. Dibur means loosely translated speech, but more deeply translated, dibur means a bringing down from theory into practice. In Hebrew, the word dabar means hanhaga. It means control, conduct, taking theory and putting it into practice, right? Dabar echad lador means a leader of a generation. Yadber amim tachtenu means to control nations. It means... We translate it in conventional Hebrew as speaking. But speaking really means taking an abstract theory and putting it into expression in the world, right? We spoke a week or two ago about the theory of speech, and that is really a much deeper idea. Not simply speaking with the mouth, it is bringing an idea into manifestation in the world. That is called the fourth level, that's called dibur, and the fifth level is called maaseh, which means action, right? Where the thing is not a translation of thought into action, it's the action itself, that's called maaseh. Asiyah means that which is done with the hands. So those are the five levels, right? If you think about it, those are five natural levels. First, it must be the will for the thing, the desire. Then that desire, that's called yesh me'ayin. Why do you have a desire for something? There's no reason. It wells up within you because it is there. You can't go back. You can't look for the source of an original source. That's not coherent. So first there is that desire. Then it takes shape in the mind. That's called a machshava, a thought. Then it takes graphic shape. Hirhur always means with the thing, the word hirhur in Hebrew is two equal parts. Hirhur. It means when the thing is actually the point of origin in thought and then the point of definition in picture. Right? It's always graphic thoughts. It's very interesting. The sages, when they talk about fantasies, thoughts of sin, sinful thoughts, are called hirhurhe avera, lustful thoughts. The sages never call them machshavas of avera. They never call it thoughts of sin. They always call, because thoughts are too abstract. Those don't bother anybody. It's hirurim that bother people, where there's graphic images, right? What bothers a person is where there's a tangible graphic element to the thing, right? An imaginary element that can be imagined. That's called hirur. It's now got graphic content, but it's not yet in the world of expression. Then dibur, which is translation into action, conventionally we call it speech, and then you have the final manifestation. Those are the five levels of speech. There are five worlds, I'm sure you're familiar with that, five Kabbalistic worlds, right? We live in one of three lower worlds. Right? This world we live in is called Asiya, that's the final world. There's a world above this called Yetzirah, which is the world of formation. There's a world above that called the world of Bria, the world of creation, the coming into being of the worlds. The world above that is Hashem himself, that's above the world. And of course, that name of Hashem is a manifestation of something very, very deep that in the Kabbalistic works is known as whatever it's known as. It's got its own terminology. It's a higher human form in the upper world that is represented in these layers. So you have four worlds. And of course, there's the root of that, which is beyond all human understanding, is the fifth one. So you have five layers to every structure in the world. Incidentally, that's why the world is made with Hashem's hand, and the hand has five fingers. Torah says, the verse says, I cast the world with my hand and the heavens with my right hand. Right? Yimini, tipcha shamayim, means yimini yasta, yadi yasta aretz, my hand makes, hand in Hebrew always means the left hand. The left hand is always the hand of control and limitation. The word yad in Hebrew, which is a hand, spells die, the same letters, which means enough, to stop, to limit. And yimini, and my right hand makes the heavens, which is the unlimited world, right? That's always right and left, the hand that begins and produces, and the hand that limits. Those are the two hands. And each of those two layers of creation have five elements, obviously. So that every process, every element in the world, every structure has these five layers. Five layers to thought, five layers to the soul. The soul has five layers. Ideation, as we said, has five, and the soul has five layers. The lowest level of the soul is called the nefesh. The nefesh is the part that actually engages the body. In technical terms, it's called shitufa de gufa. It's where the soul meets the body. It's that part of the soul that is almost tangible. It has cravings and sensuous desires and hungers and passions and the things that an animal has. Right? Those things we share with the animal. They move the body. That part of the soul that animates, the word anima in Latin means a soul. Right? The soul that animates, that moves the body. The soul moves the body. That's called the nefesh, right? The nefesh, the word nefesh in Hebrew has three meanings. Nefesh means comes to rest. Vayinafash, we say, right? Comes to rest, because that is where the soul meets the body and comes to rest, right? Nefesh also means desire, the desire of the body, not the higher desire, the desire of the body to have. And the third meaning is to give back and make more. Nafish in Aramaic means, nafish tuva means to manufacture more, to make more. Right? Those are the three meanings of nefesh. So nefesh is the lowest part of the soul. In fact, that part of the soul Kabbalistically inhabits the liver. There's no accident that in English it's called the liver. That's where the life force connects with the body. In Hebrew it's called the kaveh, the heavy part. It's called heavy, right? And of course the liver is nothing other than blood. The blood is where the nefesh is, right? So that's where it is. The next level of soul is called the ruach, which already is very undeveloped in an animal. That's much more developed in humans. The ruach is the inner process, one's inner life, one's thoughts and one's, right, one's intellectual world, not the cravings and animal drives, but the world of thought and concept. That's called ruach. Ruach means movement, wind, movement of air. That's always a process. That's called ruach. That, according to the deeper wisdom, is in the heart, which is always a process of movement. What's in the chest level, what's in the lower level, is always connection to the world, right? Connection to the material world keeps the body going. Reproduction produces one in the next generation, engaging the world in that way. The middle of the body, the chest, is where the heart and lungs are. That's always a movement. The lungs, ruach, means breath, wind, breath, movement, right, of air. That is called the heart. That's where one experiences oneself. The higher level is called the neshama. That really is in the brain. That's the third of the levels, which is already verging on sanctity. In fact, the neshama is so high and so holy, we have very little contact with it. All of our inner experience is really called ruach. Do we have any contact with the neshama? Maybe in very rare moments of inspiration, where you suddenly hit with an amazing idea that comes from nowhere, that experience of suddenly, or when you try to solve a problem, right, and you work on it for ages and ages, and you work on it and work on it, and suddenly when you lose control, or you relax, or you wake up, and you have a tremendous inspiration of an answer, right, then you've got the chutzpah to say, I worked it out. I didn't work it out, it was a gift. That is called neshama, right? Just a moment, the Kabbalistic sources say, it touches and doesn't touch. It can never it's too powerful to inhabit the brain permanently. So it, although it belongs in the brain, it hovers above. If it was in the brain, you wouldn't be able to survive. Much too powerful a light for the brain. So it hovers above the brain and only touches occasionally, right? By the way, this is why people sleep. Why do we sleep? Because if it shone inside, even a little of this shone in the brain permanently, the fuses would melt. And so what happens is after this number of hours, a day or the most 3 days, in most cases, you can't go more than 3 days without sleeping. The fuses eventually burn out and trip and a person has to sleep, right? That is why, it's also why you can't concentrate on one thing for more than a very short space of time. Try to concentrate on one single idea for 60 seconds. If you can concentrate on one thing for 1 minute, you are in the top very small percentage of humanity. Very, very unusual. You concentrate very powerfully. At the most potent moment of concentration, you suddenly realize sometimes you can't even remember what you were thinking about. Right? There's a tripping of fuses, all part of the same experience. And that is because the neshama is too high, and it is above really the head, and it shines in. It actually occupies the place where you wear tefillin, where a baby's head is open. Baby's born with a skull, you can feel the brain pulsate, right? That's the point of connection. And there are two higher levels above that, which are very, very high. Those haven't been seen on earth since the days of Adam and Eve. Technically, they're called Chaya. Chaya is the world of completely above the human being. Chaya means a woman giving birth. Right? That's where life is generated. In that world are very deep things, the source of all healing, for example, healing for all illness. If you could reach that world, there'd be no illness. And that's where pure life is coming into the world. And above that is a place called Yechida, which is really where the soul is one and the same as the divine source. Yechida means where they become one, right? At that point, we'd all be connected. If you could reach that level, you wouldn't be you different than me. Right? We'd all be part of the source. Again, five layers to the soul. Let's take a voyage through Chumash briefly and see if we can understand how each of the books... Are we clear? Are we clear about the pattern? That's the theme. And it pays to understand because all things in the world, the human motivation and the human structure and all Torah aspects are always based on these five patterns. And it's the deepest explanatory pattern, right? You understand this? It fans out into all mechanisms in the world. Let's go through the five books of Chumash and see how they reflect this pattern. The first is the book of Bereshit, right? Genesis. Genesis is the place where it contains everything. It's the root. That's the seed. It's the ultimately male phase, if you like. Dvarim is ultimately female. You know that the beginning of a process is always considered male in the deeper world. The end of a process is always considered female. Production of a child. The father gives only half a genetic code. That's all he gives, right? There's nothing of the father left when a child is born. When a newborn baby is born and you hold that child in your hands, every gram of that child is formed by the mother. There's nothing left of the father in the child. The only image, the only element of the father that's in a newborn child is half a genetic instruction someplace. But all the material is produced by the mother, right? She produces the whole... This is why we always refer to Hashem as male. Why do we always refer to God as male? Because we narrow-minded, anti-feminist, you know, chauvinist, medieval. It's because points of origin that are multipotential are called male. Hashem is always referred to as male in his essence because that is the point of origin. That is all possibilities. But when it's brought down into the world in Hebrew is always feminine. All the words for the earth and the world in Hebrew are female. Right? Adama is feminine. Even if the word doesn't look feminine like Eretz, but it takes the feminine. Vessels are feminine in Hebrew. Stones are feminine. The Hebrew word for us... Shekhinah. Shekhinah means the female version. That means Hashem's presence in the world is called the Shekhinah. You know what Shekhinah means? It's similar to Shachin. It means he's like a neighbor. It means he's here. He dwells within, right? That's the female. Obviously, the source has male and female manifestations. So the Shekhinah is the female manifestation of the divine that is inside the world. But the male manifestation is not yet in the world. And that's why it's called female, because it's in the world. Even the word for a stone, which is the building block of reality, right? The world is formed from Evan Shtia, that means the stone of formation. The word Evan is a feminine word, even though you wouldn't know to look at the word. Actually, some deep sources say that the word Evan in Hebrew is a contraction of Av and Ben, which means father and son. And when you mesh them together, you get a feminine. It's in the woman that father transitions into son, right? It's in her. She affects that transition and produces one from the other. So that is the concept. The woman, the female, is always, She's called Gvura, the left-hand side, gives limitation, gives shape, gives specific form from the formless potential of the male. So Genesis is the book of origins, of beginnings, contains everything, contains the roots of the Jewish people, the forefathers, right? That is the book in which the process begins, and you cannot understand a reason. There's no reason why it happens. It happens because Hashem is good and wants to do it. You can't, again, points of origin are only because they are. There's nothing forcing him to do it, and therefore the world manifests. What's the second book? The book of Shmos. That is the book that is already where the Jewish people are formed. They come into specific formation. The book of Shmos begins with the names. Right? What's it called in English? Exodus, no? Exodus. They are formed in the exile in Egypt. They go through that crucible of fire, as it were, and they come out as a people formed specifically. That is the book of... So the first book, as you could say, is Hashem's book. The second, if you like, is ours. We are now formed in that image as a Jewish people. The third, like always, is the point of connection. Vayikra, the third book, is almost all. There are only two incidents in the whole book that are not dealing with the concept of the Mishkan. The Mishkan, or the sanctuary, right, in the desert, which later became the temple, is the place of meeting of these two worlds. What is the concept of the Mishkan? Always, the pattern of three always is first is the one side, the male side, then you have the opposite side, the female, and the third is always the harmony between the two. In the body, for example, the right hand is the male side, the left hand is the female side, and then the center where they meet and balance and harmonize, that's always called the third element. It's always point of connection. What is the Mishkan? What is the sanctuary? What happens there? There Hashem meets us. What happens in the Mishkan is all points of contact, points of connection. For example, sacrifices that are offered there. What are sacrifices? They are the form of the world's eating. Eating is always necessary to hold body and soul together. Why do we eat? Why do we eat? Eating is necessary to keep the opposites of spirit and physical together. If you don't eat, the two begin to distract themselves from you, become faint. And if you don't eat long enough, they separate completely. Eating keeps the spiritual in the physical. The sacrifices are, as it were, where the world eats. The Shekhinah is kept in the world during the sacrifice. That's also the place of speaking. We hear Hashem's voice speak from between the two kruvim. In fact, the service in the temple is what keeps the world alive. The sacrifices, both sacrifices and ketores. Ketores means the incense. The incense, the word ketoret in Hebrew means to connect. It means to bond together, right? One is food, which is energizing the body, and one is smell, incense, which energizes the soul. We smell spices on Motzei Shabbat, when Shabbat goes out, to energize the soul. Right? That is why it's, in fact, the highest type of work that's done in the Mishkan, because it is feeding the soul directly. Right? So, you know that it should be obvious, really. Smell is done with the organ of breathing, right? Which is the organ of life. Why does the nose smell and breathe? And sneeze, for that matter. You know, any organ in the body that has more than one function means that those functions have a commonality. Otherwise, they wouldn't be built into the same organ, right? The mouth has three functions that are common: speaking, eating, and kissing. They're all functions of connection. Speaking, people connect with each other. Eating, body and soul are kept connected. And the mouth is a natural organ of affection. Mother shows affection for a child. What does she do? She slobbers all over it. What kind of natural thing is that? But the mouth is the point of... Right? It doesn't make any sense, I can assure you. Medically disastrous. But that's because it's an organ of connection. All three aspects of connection put into the same organ. Why does the nose smell and breathe? Because that's the place of life. When the human being's created, Hashem breathes the soul of life into the nose. And that's what sneezing is, by the way. You know why we say bless you when someone sneezes? Because before, in the early days of the world's history, before illness and old age set in, people died by sneezing. The breath of life was breathed into the nose, and it was forcibly breathed out. A person only sneezed once. You sneezed once. The Gemara says people walk in the street, and they came to time to die. They would sneeze out the soul, and that's how they would die. Right? There was no gradual phasing out. And so it's the organ of life, and smell always is a sense of life. Things that are alive smell wonderful. Things that separate from life smell bad. The more alive they were, the worse they smell when they separate. The more alive a thing is, nothing smells as good as a newborn baby. Even a newborn child's excrement is clean, smells sweet. If a child's only nursed, doesn't eat any extraneous food. The law is that if a child is soiled, a newborn child, you can say blessings in front of the child, use Hashem's name. There's nothing offensive about it, right? But nothing smells as bad as a dead human body. When a thing separates from life, right? And the nose is always, that is the organ, when Mashiach comes, it says he will smell Yiras Hashem. He will not look at spiritual content, he'll be able to smell it. That means things that are connected to life are always, and that's what the incense is. It is that connection with life, and that's why, and the Mishkan has all these things. Who serves in the Mishkan? The priests, right? The Levim and the Kohanim. The book in English is called Leviticus, right? It's called the Levim. By the way, Levi means to connect, to accompany. Levaya means to connect. They're the ones who connect. The Mishkan, the people who work there, the Kohanim, are between us and Hashem. Now, the Maharal says an amazing thing. The word Kohen in Hebrew adds up to 75. Kohen, a Kohen. Kohen is 75. Maharal says it's a way of saying, how do you say in Hebrew 7.5? How do you say between 7 and 8? 75. Again, yeah, 7 is the natural world always, right? 7 elements of the natural world as we know. 8 is always the miraculous, the transcendent. 8 is always in the miraculous world, the higher world. Shmone in Hebrew means oil, floats above. Shmone, the word for 8 in Hebrew, you rearrange the letters, it spells neshama, the soul, which is above the body. Right? You rearrange the letters again, it spells Mishnah. The Mishnah is where the written and oral law meet. So the letters of 8 are always beyond. Bris Milah, circumcision, done on the 8th day, giving the body the ability to transcend. Hanukkah celebrates a miracle, it's 8 days long. 8 is always beyond the natural world. So 7 is natural, 8 is transcendent. 75, that's halfway between 7 and 8. The Kohen is halfway between this world and the next. The Talmud has a discussion, is he our agent to represent us to Hashem, or Hashem's agent to represent him to us? He's both of those. And therefore he wears no shoes, because he's above, yeah, he's not connected to the world, and he serves in the Mishkan. So the Kohanim are those agents who are fulfilling the function of the Mishkan, and they bond this world to the next, and it's always the point of, that's what Sefer Vayikra is, the book that deals, Teres Kohanim is dealing with all of these points of connection. Why it's necessary is very important to understand also. The deep secret is that Genesis, the book of Bereshis, the world was created but destroyed. The world was created, but man sinned, right? Man and woman, they broke it down. The world needs a new and perfect creation. The secret of Vayikra is that Hashem recreates the world again in the microcosm of the temple. You know, everyone should know this, is that the Mishkan, the sanctuary, is the source of the laws of Shabbat. How do you keep Shabbat? You don't do the 39 things that were done to build the Mishkan. Why? Because the Mishkan, that sanctuary, that little tent of meeting, was built and constructed in the desert using 39 creative activities. Kabbalistically, those are the actions that Hashem used to create the world. So the Mishkan is the microcosm of the world. And just like on Shabbat, he stopped creating the world, on Shabbat we stop the 39 activities that are used to create the Mishkan. If you want to know what you may not do on Shabbat, you go back to the 39 things that were done to build the Mishkan. It's those 39 things that you have to stop. There's a very clear indication here that the Mishkan is the second version, if you like, of the creation, but this time in terms of perfection, right? You notice the Torah says by the Mishkan, time and time again, Kasher Tziva Hashem, as Hashem commanded. In Genesis, it wasn't as Hashem commanded. He commanded them not to eat the fruit, and they ate the fruit. So he recreates a second version of the world, which we have a hand in. And this time it's Kasher Tziva Hashem, exactly the way it was meant to be, so it was built in perfection. Yeah? And that is the secret of the book of Leviticus. And then we come to the fourth book of Bamidbar. Where does that place us in the hierarchy? Let's understand this. Amazing thing to understand. What is the fifth level? We said the first level is Ratzon, desire, Hashem's desire to create the world. The second is Machshava, the thought, right? The third is where it comes into specific graphic representation. The fourth is called Dibur, right? Speech. Remember that? The fourth is called Dibur. The fourth book of Chumash is called Bamidbar. Dibur. Again, we're used to translating it as Bamidbar, meaning in the desert. What's it called in English? No, not Jerusalem. Numbers. Bamidbar means in the desert, right? Bamidbar, in the desert. But the Hebrew word midbar is the same word as speaking. No accident that, right? The word is bamidbar or bamedaber, in the speaking. What does this mean? And by the way, the whole book's about speaking. The whole book of Bamidbar is about speaking. It's all speech. The Jewish people are going through the desert. You know what happens in the book of Bamidbar? One breakdown after another of speech. All the faults of speech. The Jewish people are tested 10 times. Each time is a breakdown of speech. Right? For example, Misoinani, they complained. The second one you have there is Miriam and Aaron speaking Lashon Hara about Moshe, using speech wrongly. The third one is the Meraglim. They go in and they speak bad about the land of Israel. That's speech again. Then you have Korach, right? Machlekes, fighting, arguing, using speech wrongly to cause dissension and argument among the Jewish people. And then you have hitting the... You have Bilam, Balak, cursing the Jewish people, using speech for a curse. And then you have Moshe Rabbeinu hitting the rock instead of speaking to the rock. This is the withholding of speech improperly. The whole book is a book of the errors and the breakdown of speech. By the way, while we're on the subject, it's no accident that the fifth book is Devarim, the spoken things, the words. Bamidbar is the place of speaking and speech, and Devarim is the words that actually come out, right? That's what it means. But that's what Bamidbar. Why is it called Bamidbar? Because a desert, what does desert have to do with speaking? Midbar is a desert. What does it have to do with speech? The secret is this, that in Hebrew, every word that starts with me means from, to exclude, right? Mikem means some of you, not all of you, exclude some of you. Me means to take it away from. Midbar means a place of no speaking. The Torah makes it clear that the desert is a place of chaos, right, where there are no roads. Speech is an organized system. I take thoughts and I put them into logical sequence, otherwise you wouldn't have any idea what I'm speaking about. Right? There's an organized process, a pathway. That's what speaking is. It tells a story. There's a road, a path. A desert is a place where there are no roads. A desert is a place where wherever you go is the road. Right? And therefore it's called a midbar, a place where there's no speech. The Jewish people are given a road in the desert. That means the whole history of the Jewish people is Hashem takes us through an impossible place. The whole process of the Jewish people in the desert is that He takes us through. There are two phases, of course. There's walking through the desert for all those years, and then what's called Midbar Ha'amim. We then go through an exile throughout thousands of years in the desert of the nations where there's no place to be. Everybody try to kill us. Right? Everybody. I mean, there's no... In case you hadn't noticed. Whatever we do is wrong. Whatever we do is wrong. Israel gets attacked. They try to defend themselves. People say, it's disproportionate. You're not disproportionate means. Proportion means you only do as much as they did to you. So if there's some rockets, what do you need to do? Enough to stop it, right? So they did a certain amount. Obviously, it wasn't enough. They're right. It was disproportionate. I mean, it's still rockets, so they didn't do enough. I mean, again, proportion... But I don't see it that way. Anyway, this is called the Midbar Ha'amim. You're walking through a desert where there is no place to go unless it's forged unnaturally for us, right? That's the process. By the way, you know that Bamidbar, the fourth book, is actually three books. You know that. The book of Bamidbar is actually three books. You know, Chumash is five books, but it's actually seven. Well, it must be, obviously. Why is it seven books? Because the fourth is actually three. So that adds two more. Why is it three books? Because it fits into... Bamidbar goes up to the Misoinani, where the Jewish people complained. Until then, it was perfect. Until then, they were marching through the 42 stages in the desert. And 42 is an expansion of Hashem's name. They were going through the process of perfection on the way to Israel. And then they began the problem of mistaken speech, and then the process broke down. And there the Torah walls that off with two upside-down nuns. Amazing thing in the text. You look in the text of the Torah, they're two upside-down nuns. Nun always means something to do with the 50th, the higher world. And in those two upside-down nuns are two verses, 85 letters, Vayihi bin Sa'ir Aaron, that the Aaron was moved, was carried, right? Two verses of 85 letters. And then the book continues. So actually there are three books here. There's the book up to that point where they began the complaint. There's this amazing book of 85 letters. The Gemara says if you have 85 letters together, that has the holiness of a Sefer Torah. To save from a fire or for various other reasons, you have to bury it, right? If it's torn out. And then the book continues. So actually there are three books there. There's an amazing comment of the Chidor. Chidor was a great Kabbalist who wrote an extensive work. And in that work, he reveals an amazing secret. He says, what are these two verses? What are these 85 letters? The secret, he says, of these two verses is that there's another whole book of Torah. There's five books that we are aware of. But there's another book of Torah which is only revealed to us two verses of that book. And he reveals the secret of what that book is. He says, this is the book of the Jewish people's journey through the desert of history, which of course couldn't be written in the Torah, which is only happening now. Again, the Torah is only written as it happens. Right? Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, brought down the Torah as it evolved during his lifetime. When he died, the Torah reached the point of his death. The rest of the Torah is also, the rest of history is also Torah. But obviously it can't be written until it happens. And therefore, as we move through history, through the desert of our experience, that book is gradually being written. And one day when the Torah is finally revealed in its fullness, those two verses will be a whole book. What will the book be? The process of our moving through history with all its events and exigencies, with all the revealed meaning of all the things that we went through. And right now, the Torah reveals it only as those two root verses. By the way, Vayhi bin Soya ha'aron, when the aron being carried, the aron was the ark, right, in which the Torah was contained. That always went before the Jewish people on its journey. That is what's happening. That's the journey. You know, the first three, we didn't go into this, but the first three books are called Gadol, Gibor, Nora. Gadol, Gibor, Nora, right? Hakel, Gadol, Hagibor, Vaneru. Hashem is the great. Gadol means giving. That's Genesis. Gibor means putting to limitation and specifics. That's the book of Shemos. Nora always means, Nora means awesome, let's say. But it, that that describes the Mishkan, with the ark as the center of the Mishkan. The Ari points out that the word Nora, when you spell it backwards, spells Aron. So you have Kel, God will give of a Nora, the Nora, that aspect of Hashem, which manifests in the temple, right? Nora, Nora Hashem b'mikdashecha, Hashem's Nora, that appears in the Mishkan, that is the Aron, which is where the Torah is actually manifest. And then you move into the book of Bamidbar, which is the journey through the desert and all the problems of speech. And finally, you come to Dvarim, which is the book in which, what is the meaning? What is the fifth always? The fifth is always the maximally female level, where the thing actually reaches its, what does a woman do? She takes the whole process and gives it back as it was originally. What is a child? It's a replica of the parents. The female is always a reduplication, right? It's always a doubling of what you had before. Why is Dvarim a repetition of what came before? Why do the Ten Commandments need to be repeated? Because the first time they're given in source, and then there's the woman's production, as it were, the female dimension, where the thing manifests. The first four books of Torah, Hashem speaks. The fifth one, Moshe Rabbeinu, Eile HaDvarim Asher Dibar Moshe. These are the words that Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. They well up from the receiver. The first four come down. The fifth is where the vessel contains and echoes, reflects what it's given. Right? Where the child is born, as it were. And therefore, the book of Dvarim is where we speak Torah. And of course, it's just sensitive ear here will perceive this is where the root of the oral law is, where we can create Torah of our own, right? We can work at it and understand it and generate it. That is all, has its origin in the book of Dvarim. It's also not an accident, of course, that the book of Dvarim takes place on the border of Israel. What does it mean? The Jewish people are about to move into the land. The land's ultimate feminine level, right? The Gemara says when a man gets married, the woman is his field. The woman is a man's field. That means we learn the acquisition of marriage from Stay Ephron. By his buying of a field, we learn the laws of marriage. A burial field, of course. It wasn't a field where wheat is planted. It's where people are planted. Right? Where Abram and Sarah, Adam and Chava, they, that is that sort of a field where people, as it were, are planted in terms of the resurrection. So that is the book of Dvarim, where you're on the border of Israel, which is the ultimate place of an earth that is the source of life and resurrection. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch points out a beautiful thing. You know, many of the Torah's laws are repeated in Dvarim. The Ten Commandments and many other laws. Points out very beautifully. You know which laws are repeated in Dvarim? All the laws that are needed for living in Israel. Well, they're on the border of Israel. They're about to go in. So the laws that are repeated are the laws that we never needed in the desert, but you will need in Israel, right? And that, of course, is the ultimate feminine level. The land. Women have a love for Israel. You know that? Women have a special love for Israel. It's well known. It's well known. Where did we learn this from originally? The daughters of Tzlofchad, you remember? The daughters, five daughters of Tzlofchad, they came to Moshe and they said, we are women and we don't want to lose our inheritance in the land. So what happens if we each marry a man from another tribe, our ancestral land will be lost. And Hashem gave a special instruction, they should marry relatives from their own tribe. By the way, no accident that there were five of them. That's the female dimension. So there were five daughters of Tzlofchad, and they were the ones who expressed a special love for Israel, and that's always the feminine dimension. Anyway, what we learned this evening is a thematic overview, if you like, or introduction to the five levels, why Chumash is phrased in terms of, why did Hashem have to write it in five books? He could have written it as one long string of words. But Chumash means five, and it is always representing the five dimensions of the world, right? And that's the pattern. The Ten Commandments, nothing other than this, the five and five of the right hand and the left hand, the first five laws between us and Hashem, the second five laws between human beings. And wherever you look in Torah, you'll find that these are the five layers, the five elements of Hashem's name, the five mystical worlds, the five parts of the soul, the five parts of all thought, the five books of Chumash. Okay, we'll stop there.
Oh, they make five?
Yeah. Okay, they told me how to speak about something here, so...
The Ma'afilim.
Is that also one of those in that category? Or is it the same one? Because it's one of those.
Didn't they try to go into Israel?
Yeah, but
it
has nothing to do
with. I don't think so. Not it sounds like a preempting of the final stage. Not by speech, but just trying to rush in.
Right, okay, of course.